And so it is. I always say too, like in middle school reading interventionists, I just look at them like, is there a full-time social worker with you? Because you need it, because there's so much emotional baggage that that sixth, seventh, and eighth graders face. They-
Welcome to season two of Schoolin' Around, a podcast hosted by Branchy Minds, featuring prominent leaders, subject matter experts, and thought innovators with their perspectives on the current challenges facing K-12 education. I'm your host, Larissa Napolitan, a former teacher, instructional coach, and a member of the Branchy Minds team, here to lead conversations with educational leaders and experts, and to shine a light on phenomenal educators and those that are on a mission to transform our schools and the lives of students. Maybe you've been listening for a while, or this is your first episode. If you like what you hear, would you do us a favor by rating and reviewing us on iTunes? This is a fantastic way to tell us you enjoy what we are creating. Also, if you want more MTSS resources, sign up for our weekly newsletter using the link in the show notes. Well, today on the podcast, we are welcoming Dr. Catherine McKnight, who is an educational consultant, researcher, author, specializing in the area of adolescent literacy. And as a former middle school English teacher, I am so excited to chat with her because, well, we could just talk about it all day long. Catherine, welcome to the podcast.
Yay! I'm happy to be here. I love talking about our hormonal population, about teenagers. We don't give enough airspace and time, I think, on them. So, which we'll get into, I'm sure, today during the podcast.
Well, just to kind of start us out, I would love to hear, I like to ask kind of a fun question as we kick off the podcast, but what's that secret skill or talent that you don't use for like your everyday work, but it's a skill that you have?
Well, I'm actually debating between two. I'm obsessed with the Great British Baking Show. So I make I'm a mean baker. I'm really good at baking. And then another one too is that I studied at Second City in Chicago. I actually wrote a book on it, and I guess it is kind of education related, but I'm a graduate of the Second City Conservatory on Improvisation. And I won't quit my day job, but Stephen Colbert, Tina Fey, Rachel Dratch, you know, all of them were our card carrying members of the Second City conservatory program. So yeah, so that's kind of a secret talent. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really fun. And I think we have a lot in common because I bake as well. And I was I have a theater minor, so I'm very familiar with the improv.
Well, I wrote a book on it, connecting it to education. Yep. And how we can use it to develop content knowledge and literacy skills. So maybe that's another podcast. The connections with education are enormous, and people don't realize
that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast because here at Branchy Minds, we talk a lot. And here on the podcast, we do talk a lot about different areas of struggles that students have and just different issues. And one of them is secondary literacy. We're seeing a lot of middle school and high school students still struggling to learn how to read. And so I would love to just chat about, kind of like open it up and just talk about what do you notice about the trends in schools they're currently facing around secondary students' literacy, and how maybe has that changed over the years?
Yeah, it's alarming, actually, especially post pandemic, what I'm seeing in classrooms. I was alarmed before the pandemic, and I always say the pandemic just really just emphasized even more. It just became more apparent what the inequities were, what our challenges are in education. But, you know, let's talk specifically. So when we talk about middle school, high school, just for clarification, I'm talking about sixth grade and up. And so sixth through 12th grade. And so what I'm seeing right now, especially post-pandemic, some would say there's four, some would say there's five levels of comprehension. I like to simplify things. There's three. So literal, inferential, and then evaluative comprehension. And for learning to get sticky And for us to engage in deep comprehension, we need evaluative, you know, that evaluative level is that where deep comprehension lies. And how do you get kids there? And a lot of that has to do with questioning. So this goes back to the question, you know, to the original question that you asked, is what I see is basically pre-pandemic, I'd sit in a classroom and I might hear like one inferential question, a couple of inferential questions, maybe one evaluative. Evaluative are usually like essential questions. Now all I see is literal. I just see literal everywhere in every content area. And it's very rare that I see essential questions. And it's a lot of questions like find the main idea and three pieces of evidence. And there's nothing wrong with that skill. But when it gets exacerbated, when that's all you're doing, and that's why you're prompted to read the text, this leads to a lack of motivation. And a lot of teachers are reporting stamina issues as well, that the kids don't have stamina. If they don't read more than two pages, they won't read more than two pages. And so I see that was a problem before the pandemic, and it's gotten worse. So higher level questions that are critical. We have way too many low level questions that don't prompt students to really read at that deeper and higher level of comprehension. And also the another big thing that I'm seeing a lot of is that there's no scope and sequence. So I see ELA courses where there is no scope and sequence. There is not a clearly articulated curricula for 6th through 12th grade. And that's problematic for 50,000 different reasons. You know, you don't know where you're heading if you don't have the plan. And if you don't have the plan written out and everybody's agreeing to it and adheres to it, there's going to be massive gaps. And that also leads to much lower level kinds of instruction that I've seen. And then also, it's a rare exception that I will go into a high school and I'll say, hey, what's the literacy plan? And can actually hand it to me. I would say overwhelmingly, schools don't have literacy plans for all teachers, yet every state that I can think of has literacy standards for all content areas. We are still in this debate about the fact of who teaches reading and writing skills. Well, it's very clear in the standards and what states you know, what they have articulated is that it's everybody's responsibility, but there's still that misconception that I have to teach CAT as a high school chemistry. And it's like, no, you don't, but you do need to teach kids how to comprehend your content area through written text that's specific to your discipline, and then how to express what you know and understand about that information and develop the critical thinking. So there's still an overwhelming assumption that it's an ELA teacher's job. And it's like, no, it's everybody's responsibility, of course. And that's an even deeper comprehension, you know, conversation to have. But when I started my teaching career as a baby teacher 35 years ago, we were debating that then. It's like, can we get over it already?
Oh my gosh, so true.
Let's get over it. Move on.
I think it's like 10 years ago, well, 15 years ago now when I started teaching, and I come in as a seventh grade teacher and we're talking about how do we reinforce reading skills in other classes. And you'd have these science and social studies teachers grumble and I'm like, they need to still write in your class. They need to understand. And honestly, it's like that technical reading that we need to for comprehension. And I just think, well, why would you not want to reinforce that, right? And so like the work that it took to kind of build that environment and that culture, yes. And I think when you talk about like the literacy plans, it makes me think of what is the school doing to build that culture of reading? And it's not just, it just shouldn't just be the English teachers' jobs. And often we're the ones that took the lead on that. But like, what is your district plan? And, you know, you're talking about scope and sequence. And I think it's when kids come into sixth, seventh grade, they don't just stop being readers and they just stop learning how to read, how to build those skills. And I think this is another side note, but I think the struggle sometimes with the reading, and I think in my conversations with maybe math teachers and science teachers, is that math and science tend to be linear. Like the things, you know, you build on the skills. You learn this, then you learn this and this. Well, in English, it's something more like a cyclical. It mm-hmm. all builds on each other. And you're constantly reviewing the same skills, but to a higher level. Mm-hmm. I think that sometimes it's hard. It's a hard thing for teachers to comprehend that. Yeah. To wrap their heads around and see that, because they're sort of centered in on their content area, which is very, very secondary mindset.
So, yeah, exactly. And in response to that, you know, three things. The first thing is, you know, I also was a professor for 15 years at two different universities. And, you know, one of the things that I encountered, one of my frustrations with university life was that to get anything changed as far as programs, and it took forever. And so our students, for example, didn't have a required course in adolescent reading comprehension. If you were lucky, you had a course in content reading and writing, but it was basically, here's 50 different strategies. But folks didn't, you know, I know that many of our students didn't understand why you were doing them. They didn't understand the science behind that, you know, why you use a summarization strategy like GIST as opposed to this. Like, what are you accomplishing in that? And it's not just developing that, you know, developing key reading comprehension skills. It's also being able to delve deeply into discipline-specific study and more complicated texts. So that's one thing. And then also, in addition, you know, to just adolescent reading. So I always say that the solutions are simple. It's the implementation and sustainability that's the hard part, because we're changing habits. And I always say, if habits were easy to change, then I wouldn't, you know, need to lose weight. And so those are the hardest things. And then we use our experiences rather than science and what we know. And so incumbent on that, you know, connected to that, is that I have one school that I'm working with right now, one middle school. And I have to say this as a researcher, there was a lot of things, a lot of variables in play. So you can't isolate it into one variable. So I have to say this as a researcher. But in the last 18 months, they now have a clearly defined scope and sequence for 6th, 7th, and 8th grade ELA. The social studies and science teachers, social studies in particular, are asking more higher level questions, getting writing, evidence-based writing about primary sources in there. And really, they're very cognizant now of how they structure their lessons. So we have that. And then we also have what I call literacy and learning centers. And it's a model that I developed that's center stations, rotations for middle school and high school, because it's got to look different than it does in elementary. But the idea is getting those small collaborative groups together so kids are talking about what they're learning and developing their reading and writing skills. So they use a data system. I won't mention the company, but I'm sure many of you use it, but have a data system. They did their September initial assessment, and then they just did their January. And in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, their mean growth was 131%. And so I would say that the solutions are simple. It's the implementation, the sustainability. And one of the key things about this school is they have an outstanding instructional leader, and the faculty is very professional. And they want to do better, and they knew they needed to address those things. So once they did, and all these things started coming into place, they're growing like crazy, like nothing is stopping them. And so, you know, as opposed to other schools that I work in, where leadership is not as strong, and there isn't that collaboration and follow through, because I can't be there 180 days, you know, and it's not the job of one person, it's got to be the collective. So that's, you know, really, you know, again, you know, going back to your initial question, is I see a lot of find the main idea and three pieces of evidence. That's the purpose for reading the text. I see lots of low level questions, like, what was Larissa's neighbor's dog's name? It's like, who cares? I can Google that. You know, it's irrelevant. But if I ask a question like, how can an individual inspire change? That's worth addressing. And what I find that when students have some choice in their reading materials, and notice I said the word some, because we'll talk about it in a little bit, some choice in their reading, and they have a good question to address, and they can talk to each other about their reading and writing, that's where the magic happens. And that's where you can really grow kids.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to comment on the higher level questioning. And I found that most of my students in middle school, and I taught eighth grade, and at the end was like, they really wanted nothing to do with these boring questions. Like, who does? We kind of have to ask the more enticing, meaning question for them to really engage. And like, that was hard because I had groups of students that really struggled. I mean, they couldn't even get into the text because they struggled with retention in general. And then the other group was, they would be like, how dare you ask me these silly questions? And I think that, you know, in the age of AI and all the things we're talking about, like the way that your curriculum, to make your curriculum proof, is to ask things that require thought and heart and sort of the deeper level thinking. And so I think that that's interesting that you noticed that in sort of in the curriculum, the higher level questions, I think that maybe the default, and I don't know if the default is just me speculating, but I think it is kind of going, oh, we know our kids are behind. So let's start with this lower level expectations because we know they're behind. And so, you know, we all have to get to that point that when we can go higher. But I think in secondary, you can't wait. You have to do it all sort of together.
Yeah. Well, and this is our last chance. And so, and let me make a distinction too. You know, we're primarily talking about kids who can decode and that they don't have holes in phonics and phonemic awareness, because we do have that population too. And that population is larger than it ever has been. And so we're primarily talking about, you know, kids who can decode. Kids who can't decode, who are still on that fundamental level, must have, I'm not saying need, must have, and are entitled to reading intervention. And that's not the ELA teacher who just graduated from teacher school. Unless they have a reading endorsement, they're not qualified, or a reading specialization, they really aren't qualified. It's like asking the chemistry teacher to go teach geometry and algebra. And they use math in science, but they don't have that expertise. Reading is a specialized field. And I didn't learn about reading until I went to graduate school. My career started also as an ELA, ELA and social studies, middle school, high school teacher. And I didn't have that background until I went to graduate school. So it's really unfair. And I get this all the time too, is, we can't fit it in the schedule. I'm like, this is a life or death issue. You know, if you have a sixth grader who still doesn't have those foundational skills down, this is their last opportunity. And it is our obligation to make sure that, you know, that student is literate, you know, by the time they graduate eighth grade, 12th grade. And anything else is unacceptable. You can tell I feel a little bit strongly about it, but I really do believe in my heart that this is a social justice issue as well.
This kind of ties into what I wanted to talk about a little bit is the science of reading. And then, you know, because there's this big push in literacy instruction about the science of reading, you know, and I often hear about it at the elementary level, right? That all of this sort of early literacy stuff. But what is it that I mean, beyond intervention, maybe that's your answer, but like, what does it really mean for middle school and high school?
Yeah, you know what? And here it is. I'm going to give a shameless plug too for the podcast that I just started with my colleague, Dr. Jenny French. And we have, we just did our inaugural episode, The Science of Reading podcast for middle school and high school, because nobody talks about it. And actually, that was part of the reason why I pursued a PhD over 25 years ago, was that there's a dearth of research for middle school and high school. It's better than it was 25, 30 years ago, but there's very little out there on specifically adolescent literacy. And so, you know, so I've always been passionate about addressing it. And so nobody talks about it, but let's set up the problem first, okay? So the problem is according to the National Assessment for Educational Progress, NAEP, as it's so happily referred to, Just did a report back in, I think it was December, that eighth graders in the last 10 years have gone down 7 points in reading. Now, that's a big number on NAEP. That's an alarming number. All right. And then it gets, there's even more. And between, there was a growth study that NAEP did that looked at pre-COVID baseline aggregated data for 2018, 2019, 2016 through 2019, and looked at those scores and then compared it to fall to spring growth for 2022, 2023. We were just coming out of the pandemic. And when I read the report last summer, I was alarmed. Like, it kept me up that night because I was so upset about it. Third grade showed a growth number. So they were like they were positive four. So they kind of held steady and had a little bit of growth. But then starting in fourth grade and beyond, we were seeing in sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, the numbers were sixth grade, it was negative 19. And these should all be positive numbers. Negative 16 for seventh grade, negative 18 for eighth grade. We have a crisis right now that nobody's addressing. And when I go into schools, like, what is the plan? We need a Marshall Plan for this, because when we put the focus on third grade and made sure that we had resources, that we were training teachers, which, by the way, a sidebar, I don't know how you can become a first grade teacher and not know that there's, you know, 26 letters and 44 sounds in the English language and to teach phonics. You had a methods of reading course. How could that not have happened? That is alarming. And that falls, I will say, at the doorsteps of most teacher preparation programs. And notice I say most because there are exceptions. But how could you be a first grade teacher and not know how to teach phonics and phonemic awareness? It's crazy. So when we put attention on that and got the resources, the legislation, everything else, then we see this bump. Even during COVID, they didn't slide back. So if we're serious about this and want to make sure that we're addressing six, seven, and eight, we need to have a Marshall Plan. And part of that Marshall Plan is not, here's a program with gobs and gobs and gobs of strategies. And we can talk about that, about strategy fatigue in a second, but really training our teachers up and giving them the professional space and the professional knowledge that it's not just what, but you need to understand how and why you are using the what, so you can be a better teacher, a more equipped teacher. And I would dare say that a lot of the issues that we have with, not all of them, it's not going to erase everything, but as far as investment, engagement, stamina, a lot of these things that we have will start dissipating too, because there's a lot of executive functioning and also self-efficacy, self-awareness, self-regulation that goes on when kids become more competent. So, you know, confidence breeds competence, competence breeds confidence. And that's what my good buddy Richard Cash says all the time. And he's absolutely right. And so it is. I always say too, like in middle school reading interventionists, I just look at him like, is there a full-time social worker with you? Because you need it, because there's so much emotional baggage that sixth, seventh, and eighth graders face. They know they're lousy readers, and they you know, are struggling readers or striving readers, whatever we want to call it. And there's a lot of emotional baggage that's with them as well. But, you know, so as far as science of reading is concerned, it's nothing new. I said that when I was doing a keynote in Florida last fall, and the room just erupted in applause. It's like, I'm so glad we're doing something new. The science of reading, you know, is that corpus of research, and how have we, you know, slipped away from it and really getting into what those core skills are, or those core elements that we need to work on with adolescents. And really it boils down to summarization, self-monitoring comprehension. Kids are always, we're always going to experience difficult texts, but what do you do? Do you know what to do when you get a difficult text. A difficult text I just read 2 weeks ago were the new rules for Schedule C when I file my taxes. That was a challenging text for me. I had to use all of my strategies in order to read that. I was annotating, highlighting, everything else. And so you're always going to encounter, it's a matter of knowing what to do. What's the plan? So that executive functioning is huge. So when we think of this within the corpus of science of reading and what we know about comprehension and language development, vocabulary, writing, all of that, and we don't talk about writing as much as we should, is that it's those higher level questions, essential questions, grade level texts and above for the instructional level. Let me say it again, grade level text at the instructional level. Now, independent reading is a different story. So that's a separate bucket. But grade level text, giving kids opportunities to collaborate, to talk to each other about their reading and writing and what they're learning in their content area, and summarization is massive, and annotation, teaching an annotation system. That's really when we look at science of reading and what we know is effective, that's it. That's it right there.
Well, okay, there's a couple of things I wanted to comment on.
That was a lot.
Well, first of all, when you talk about the emotional baggage, okay, I think that something that strikes me is that when students come in, you know, when I'm teaching eighth grade and I sort of do my first, you know, first day of school, we're going to have so much fun and we're going to get into reading. I have this big classroom library, you know, trying to pump them up for the year. And I have the kids, you know, that when I ask them kind of in bell work or something, they would answer like, I hate reading and I never liked it.
Yep.
And I could always usually decipher that there was at some point in their educational career, they had a teacher or they had an experience that really made them hate reading, right?
Yep.
Yeah, really. Like, they started to struggle and they reached a point of struggle and no one gave them the tools and the skills to be able to do, you know what to do when they don't understand something exactly.
Exactly.
Like when you're approaching a really complex text or, you know, in science, you're looking at the headings and suddenly all of those different sometimes skills they could use to their advantage, they haven't been given that. And then they're made to feel bad because they can't comprehend or they're struggling. And, yeah. You know, they've gotten a poor grade or something like that. And I think that it's just thinking about how much emotions and feelings and other things that they've experienced impact their future experience. Like it's a blocker to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they don't feel open and they don't feel safe. Right. Because when you talk about some of these issues in schools, right, whether it's something like mental health crisis or some of the behaviors that we're seeing, you're right in the fact that some of those things could be solved when we help them feel confident and help them feel more safe in their learning environment, not just physically safe, but emotionally safe that, you know, and safe that they can learn and struggle. But someone's there to give me the tools. I have the people here to help me. And I think that if kids don't feel that, if they really haven't felt, if they've really have these really traumatic experiences as kids, like that's going to continue to block their learning. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's it. Continue to block their learning. And there's an emotional blockade, right? So here's some evidence to support what you're saying is that I was working in a school district. This was pre-pandemic and I had the privilege of working with them for about 3 years. And when I first entered, the two schools that I was collaborating with, there were four middle schools in the district. One was labeled a D school by the state and the other was labeled as a C. I always love it when states give letter grades to schools, you know, just like talking about the affect of that. And note my sarcasm. And so when I went in to observe and just kind of, you know, get my eyes on it and figure out what's going on in the building, everything was teacher directed. Kids were in rows, teacher lectured. This was sixth, seventh, and eighth. The kids were not engaged. Okay, so fast forward 3 years forward, and we actually presented at National Title I on what happened at these two different schools, and they were both Title I schools too. So here's what happened fast forwarded. So we implemented literacy and learning centers, which is, you know, again, my center's stations rotations model, good like content literacy signature skills, like signature strategies. So less is more, and just focused on those. And here's what happened is that the D school went up to a B school, and the C school went up to an A school, and they had some of the highest growth rates in the state. And again, I had to put my researcher hat on and say, well, you know, it's hard to determine, you know, which variable was it. But those were the things that we were doing. Now, here's the thing that supports the kicker, is that the principal, when he was presenting at National Title I, he shared that they basically got rid of in-school suspension, and that his AP, who is in charge of disciplinary things, like he needed other responsibilities because their in-school suspensions, everything else, just it practically disappeared. And it makes sense because the kids are more engaged. They feel more confident. They have more executive functioning to know what to do when things get hard. The other thing that I thought was very cool was that the gal who was the business manager for the main office, and, you know, I got to know folks really well in this district, and she just goes, oh, I'm so glad. I said, what's going on? She says, well, it's so easy for me to get subs now in the community because they all want to come here. And I'm like, what? What's going on with that? Because this was the D school. This was the rough school, the other side of the tracks. And I said, what's going on? And she says, well, word has gotten out is that when you come into sub that it's really easy because the kids basically just run the classrooms now. They know what to do. They're so established in routines. They have their lesson plan. They know what they're supposed to do. And the subs love it because of that. And then also teacher performance went up too, as far as their ratings. Yeah. Yeah. They all were up in that highly performing. Most of them were, like, more than half of them, like, migrated up to those upper levels. So, and we know the research is really clear. It's not a program that raises scores. And there might be some companies who disagree with that. It's really about teachers. And there was a wonderful meta-analysis that was done by WestEd think tank, you know, over almost two decades ago. And I don't know the specific, I may be wrong on my numbers, but it's something along the lines of like 40 hours of targeted, notice I say targeted, focused professional development leads to a mean growth rate of 12%. In students. So I always say it's people, not programs, that if you want to move the needle, that's how you move it. So you got, teachers are not the problem. Educators are not the problem. They are the solution. So how do you create that environment and you know, get the resources that folks need, that our colleagues need, in order to make these miracles happen? And so the solutions are simple. It's the implementation and sustainability that's the hard part. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I think probably teacher satisfaction. Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. Like methods to retain teachers, right? Like the, mm-hmm. like the organization right now.
Yeah.
What are the things that we can keep teachers doing? Well, one of them is to give them the development and the resources to do their job, like an investment, and, you know, and the leadership. And then when you see those rewards, acknowledging, yeah, you know, their performance and yeah. things like that. I think that that's it. Like, I think that we underestimate how, what we invest in teachers and in their development. And then we go back, they go back and invest it in students, and everyone benefits from that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And it makes us a better society too. You know?
Yeah. That's amazing. Thanks for, you know, affirming yeah. the things.
You know what, yeah. Larissa, did anybody tell you you were right today? Oh, I just did. You're right. You're absolutely right.
You know, I just think that this is the conversation. You're right. Like, it needs to be had, because when we talk about these crises that we see at middle school and high school level, I think that we have to think about, where's the root problem?
Yep.
Where's the root of the issue? And then how can we, you know, in an investment in people, how could we help solve these problems? You know, not just by a new program or anything like that. You know, here at Company, we're very passionate about helping teachers do their job. I mean, giving them the tools to do that, mm-hmm. right? So kind of thinking about other things that leaders can do, you know, for the leaders that are listening, what do you think they need to do to make a priority? What are some things they could even today or this year start to make literacy a priority at the secondary level?
Yeah. And here's the thing is that, okay, so granted I'm biased, right? Because I think strong reading and writing instruction will lead to everything. And I do believe that. I believe that reading and writing is foundational for everything, for all learning in all capital letters, and then also a lot of the social emotional challenges that we're dealing with as well. So if I were queen of a district or school and I had this problem, this is what I would do. Is I would make sure that there is a clearly defined literacy plan that everyone is expected to follow, because it's not just about, of course, it's about reading and writing skills, but it's also about that deep learning, that critical thinking, and for kids to become proficient, knowledgeable in the deep content study that they're engaged in 6th through 12th grade. Okay, so just like I'm learning other pedagogical tools, whether it's Bloom's taxonomy, DOK, or whatever, understanding adolescent reading comprehension and evidence-based writing is part of my corpus of pedagogical knowledge. Okay, that's just it. Drop mic, leave stage. So if I were queen of a school district, I would make sure that, number one, I had a clearly defined, articulated literacy plan that everybody from my building leaders to my instructional coaches to my faculty to my support personnel, like paraprofessionals, were all knowledgeable about. I'd introduce it at the beginning of the school year and make it clear that these were the rules of the road, part of teacher evaluation, part of professional development. So when I'm in schools, this is what I expect to see. If I were to come into a classroom, this is what I expect to see. So just like our students, where we need to model things and model strategies and skills and how we go about reading complicated text, how we create our own evidence-based arguments, I need to model that too as an instructional leader for this district. So when we have professional development, I'm going to make sure that you see this is what a lesson looks like when we're doing annotation. This is what a lesson looks like when we're doing summarization and in multiple content areas. Now, the sad thing about it is that just like there's tons of providers for little people to train colleagues up on phonics and phonemic awareness, there isn't a ton. So what a lot of teachers are sharing with me is that they'll get a new quote unquote program and the rep will come in and teach them how to use the program, but they don't understand the why. You know, so they know how to load up their students in the roster and assign tasks, but they don't understand why they're doing it. And then also just other good things too, like chunking instruction, collaborating, asking good questions, that's all part of it. It doesn't end in 1 year. This is our focus for 3 years. And providing those professional development opportunities, like if you want to take a course in adolescent reading comprehension, this is what we can do. A really good, she's now become a very good professional friend of mine in Florida. And she was the literacy director, and that's exactly what they did in her district. And they got to that magic number of over 70% meeting or exceeding state standards on the state assessment. And they were an A district in the state. And this is in Florida. And what she did was she created all professional development, like here's phonics phonemic awareness, here's writing in the primary level, here's this, and there were different courses that the teachers took, and there was an incentive and also a salary behind that. That's big money. How are they able to do it? State initiative helped provide that, and the district made it a priority. And it wasn't a 1 year thing. It wasn't one PD and done. It was 3 years that they did it. And it was the expectation of what was to be seen in classrooms. And so if we're serious about it, that's what needs to happen. So again, if I were queen of the district, I'd beg, borrow, and steal everywhere I could to make sure I had the money that I could actually implement this. And you know, and that's a longer conversation too, as far as like how do you implement an intervention program for middle and high school? It can be done. And, you know, so yeah, you can also listen to our podcast too. So you can put, you know, Schooling Around and then ours on there as well. And we'll get you all the answers that you need.
And yeah, and I'll add that to the show notes for everyone listening, and just add the your resources and a link to your podcast. I'll share that as well. And some books and things that you've created for that. And, you know, I looked through your website and I was like, if I had had this as a teacher,
seriously,
Right. Yeah. It's just that focused professional development and putting your money to the things that you value and you want to see the outcomes.
Exactly. And then off the record, you know, in all fairness, our colleagues, many of our building principals do not have backgrounds in reading and writing and literacy. They don't. So you can't blame the victims. And so there are resources out there. I'd be happy to share those. I have lots of conversations with schools and districts. It can be done.
Yeah.
You just got to get the knowledge.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing all your knowledge. And I'm excited to kind of share more of your resources and keep talking, because this was fantastic.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm excited to look into your podcast and learn some more.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for the opportunity of being with you today and just your enthusiasm and commitment to the topic, because we need eyes and ears on this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Schooling Around, a podcast hosted by Branchy Minds. Go ahead and subscribe to our feed wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget, if you are enjoying our content, would you do us a favor and rate and review our podcasts on iTunes? This helps others find our podcasts and lets us know how much you love what we're creating. Branchy Minds is an educational technology company using learning sciences and technology to help districts effectively personalize learning through MTSS. To learn more about us, check out our website, branchyminds.com, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn at Branchy Minds.